So it's nice to see so many of you here on what is maybe the first really hot weekend of the summer. Whoever loves a brother or sister lives in the light. As a UU minister, I don't often begin my sermons with a biblical text, but this is one that is ideal for what I have to say this morning, the light of love. We've been talking a lot about love as a central value in Unitarian Universalism for quite a while. We have t-shirts that say side with love. Some of you probably have those. We have this phrase, siding with love, to guide us in what we do in our social justice work. And for decades, we've been singing about love out of our hymn books, and you know these songs. Love will guide us. There is more love somewhere. What wondrous love is this? Answering the call of love, and several others that I could mention. And just last weekend, nearly 2,500 delegates at our General Assembly, 80% voted in favor of a new statement of UU identity that I assume some of you are aware of, putting love at the center, a graphic with love at the center and a kind of flower petal diagram to show this newly articulated set of values. And it's often said that love was the central value of Jesus's life and ministry. And if that is true, then one question I have for you this morning is, why did so many Unitarians and Universalists turn their backs on Christianity in the 19th and 20th centuries? And why do so few UUs today identify themselves as Christians? Well, I suspect you know some of the answer. And the answer resides in the history, some of the history of how Christianity developed. One of the things that fascinates me about early Christianity is how the church got its start. You might think that this is a question that was settled long ago, but it's still very much a topic of ongoing research and discovery and argument and research. Here's a book that was published just a couple of years ago. The title is After Jesus, Before Christianity. And the subtitle is A Historical Exploration of the First Two Centuries of the Jesus Movements. Notice the plural, the Jesus Movements. There appear to have been a large and greatly diverse set of Jesus movements springing up immediately after his death and spreading around the Greek-speaking world of that time, across the northern Mediterranean in particular. It wasn't until the early 3rd century, in the early 200s, in other words, that any single coordinated and widespread organization began to emerge that anyone could call Christianity. Before then, it was a hodgepodge, a potpourri. And it was around that same time in the early 3rd century that the New Testament began to be finalized, the decision makers deciding which books, and there were, at that time, some 40 or 50 Gospels detailing the life of Jesus floating around in various sections of the Mediterranean world. And they narrowed the Gospels down to 4 in number, as you know. But the theology was still all over the place, widely differing ideas about almost everything. And it took another century until the early 300s before any theological agreement and orthodoxy was settled on. And also, as many of you know, I imagine, that's when the doctrine of the Trinity was formulated, when a bunch of creeds were written, the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, the Athanasian Creed, lots of creeds. And the barbaric notion arose that an angry and vengeful God had to be appeased by Jesus' torture and death in order to pay off the sins of humanity. Now that's a version of Christianity, if you grew up in a Christian church, you probably heard about. How could such an idea arise? A monstrous God who demanded agonizing and tortured suffering as a condition for salvation? Who would want to worship a God like that? Why would such a God even be worthy of attention, much less worship? God as a cosmic child abuser that violates every precept of love that we know of in the preaching of Jesus. And yet people bought it. By the 11th century, skipping ahead a bit, that doctrine of atonement, which we call penal substitutionary atonement, became the dominant theology of the cross. And it's what I was still hearing as a little Methodist kid in my teenage Methodist church that I grew up in. Maybe Jesus loves me, the message was, and the little song tried to assure me, but God is just pissed off and wants payback. So let me say it. This is a baffling, a bizarre, and a barbaric theology. And it's what both of our Unitarian and Universalist ancestors rebelled against. The Unitarians were first, way back in the 1560s in Poland, and shortly thereafter in Transylvania, where the first churches to challenge the doctrine of the Trinity were founded, were established. But this morning I want to focus more on the Universalists, because they are the ones who specifically lifted up the idea that God is love, and that love is what Christianity is most fundamentally all about. Universalist ideas like this began circulating in the Atlantic colonies in the 1770s, the same decade as our Revolutionary War. So there was revolutionary theological activity afoot in the same decade. But it wasn't until 1774 that the first openly Universalist congregation was founded in Gloucester, Massachusetts, with a man named John Murray as its first minister. You may have heard about John Murray. Let me just briefly tell you a bit about him. He was born in England, grew up in a conservative Calvinist church, and in the 1750s, he began to hear some breakaway ministers from the Methodist Church begin to reject the Calvinistic notion that some people were saved and others were damned, and began to preach a doctrine of what they called universal salvation, universalism, in other words. John Murray was persuaded by this and began such preaching himself, but he got into trouble. He had to go underground. His wife and son, because of their poverty, eventually succumbed to illness, and he gave it all up, threw in the towel, and said, "Never, I'm giving up this life. I'm going to America to start over." And he booked passage on a ship. The ship, unfortunately, ran aground. It was headed for New York, but landed on the New Jersey shore. And he was assigned by the captain to go ashore and see if he could find some food. And he went ashore and he met, almost miraculously, I'm inclined to say, a man of Universalist sentiments who had built a chapel on his own farmland, believing that God would send a preacher to preach a Universalist message. Now, this story all comes from John Murray's autobiography, so, you know, we have to take it maybe with a grain or two of salt. But according to John Murray, this man told him, You have a vital message for the people to hear. Do not hide your light under a bowl or a bushel. Speak it out. And John Murray said, oh, no, no, I'm done with that. And the man kept insisting, and John Murray said, well, if the wind doesn't change by Sunday so that our ship can sail on, then I'll preach. And providentially, the wind did not change, and John Murray preached what is reportedly the first Universalist sermon in America. Meanwhile, up and down the Connecticut River Valley in the inland part of New England, other lay people and ministers were having similar thoughts about or against Calvinism and were beginning to develop Universalist type ideas that salvation was universal. It wasn't until 1805 that a man named Hosea Ballou, in a book called A Treatise on Atonement, I think I brought it along here, didn't I? Yeah, there it is. A Treatise on Atonement, 1805. Ballou argued that Jesus was sent by God to demonstrate and to be an example of what divine love should look like, not to be a sacrificial victim. For the Universalists, this, and they were still biblical people, Bible-believing people, this doctrine was attested by many, many passages in the Christian Bible, the New Testament. And I'm sure if you grew up in a Christian family or a church, these are familiar from the Gospel of Mark. You shall love, this is Jesus speaking, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind. And secondly, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And from the Gospel of John, a new commandment I give you, says Jesus, that you love one another as I have loved you. And from the first letter of John, beloved, let us love one another, because love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. And whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. And near the end of his, 240-page treatise on atonement, Hosea Ballou said this, let brotherly love continue. If we agree in brotherly love, there is no disagreement that can do us any injury. But if we do not agree in brotherly love, then no other agreement can do us any good. So, the Universalists believed in that way that they had the Bible behind them. And by the 1830s, both Unitarians and Universalists had moved to the point where they saw the meaning of religion and the meaning of Christianity, therefore, to be about ethical living. Religion was about living in right relationship with one another, doing good, being virtuous, with Jesus as the model for how to do that. That was the kind of Christianity that was being preached in Unitarian and Universalist churches of those days. And the parables that Jesus taught, the parable of the Good Samaritan, the prodigal son, and the Sermon on the Mount, those were quoted as examples of how people should live and what principles that they should live by. And so that's one of the things I mean when I say or ask, did Jesus and the Universalists get it right? Love was the central principle, the unifying force, not just of their lives, but in their theology. And what did love require? That we should live lovingly with one another, treat one another in the way that we wish to be treated, the golden rule. Well, a lot happened in the next 20 or 30 years at the hands of people like Ralph Waldo Emerson, whom you know something about, and the transcendentalists and the influence of Eastern religions, which showed that Christianity was not the only religion that had a golden rule. Hinduism had something like a golden rule. So did Buddhism, so did Islam. And people very naturally began to ask, well, what is so unique about Christianity anymore? And that was a fateful question for them to ask, and began the Unitarians first and later the Universalists beginning to think that Christianity was not all that unique and ethical living is what we should be focusing on. And you can recognize this in today's Unitarian Universalism. The seven principles of the UUA, which we just voted to remove from the UUA bylaws, have become for many people almost a creed, an object of worship, because we have tended to become an ethical philosophy as much as a religion. Of course, we still speak of love as a spiritual force and have for a long time. And some of us equate love with God, while others are just as happy to keep love and dispense with the word God altogether. And one of the things I want to ask this morning is that a good thing? Are we a stronger collection of churches, a stronger and more fulfilling religious tradition and movement as Unitarian Universalism, for having emphasized a list of principles and stopped talking so much about Jesus as an embodiment of what love is all about? Because we mostly have stopped talking about Jesus. Not entirely, and there are about, statistically as I remember, about 15% of Unitarian Universalists, more on the East Coast than the West Coast, consider themselves to be Christians. And I think most of them mean that in a way that emphasizes themselves as followers of the teachings of Jesus. So love is, we're talking more and more centrally these days about love as being at the center of our theology. But aside from slogans about side with love or act living on the side of love or love at the center, I don't hear a lot of more nuanced theology about love coming out of UU theologians these days. If I want to look for some serious analysis of how we should understand love in a religious sense, I find myself having to turn to Christian theologians, because UUs, for better or worse, simply are not writing a lot about it. And especially from a movement called open and relational theology, there are some really interesting developments in what I would call progressive Christianity these days that I'd like to just mention, just to make you aware of. And let me talk in particular about a guy named Tom Ord. I met Tom almost 30 years ago when I was in Claremont. And he was just finishing up a doctoral dissertation on love, on divine love. And over the years, he has continued to think about and wrestle with the meaning of divine love. Now, Tom grew up in the Nazarene Church, and if you know anything about the Nazarene Church, you know it's not the most liberal church that ever came onto the stage. To cut to the chase, Tom is coming up on trial next month for heresy in the Nazarene Church, because Tom has interpreted the love commandments in the New Testament in very much the same way that Cecil in that little Methodist church 40 years ago understood them, that Jesus put no restrictions on who is our neighbor. But Tom is charged with affirming the goodness of gay and lesbian people, and he will be on trial. But he has written prolifically, to say the least, the uncontrolling love of God, pluriform love, and I've got five or six other of his books on my shelves that I could have brought along. But despite their being written by someone who came out of the Nazarene tradition, I'm finding books like this much more helpful than anything coming out of UU circles on what love means in a religious sense. Love is a hard word to define. And yet, I think it's a word that draws us in. Jesus never gave a definition of love. He just showed what it looks like in the living of his life. For all of their talk, universalists, as far as I know, never gave any very memorable definition of love. Like Jesus, they talked about a loving God and said that God is love and left it at that. And so there's an irony here, an irony of progressive Christians, and Tom Lord is just one example because I happen to know him personally, and see him frequently at theological conferences. He's just one of many that are writing in this vein of saying that we need to interpret Christianity in a more inclusive way, that the talk of suffering as being good and sacrificial love as being some kind of noble virtue is misguided, and that we need to return to the love doctrine of the Bible as what is central in our lives. And there's some irony in progressive Christians coming back, I would say circling around, and sort of meeting us in this new proclamation that we've done with our vote at General Assembly last week, of putting love in the center. And so maybe we've, in that sense, not come all that far from a particular kind of Christianity that maybe we should take another look at. Or maybe we are actually helping some kinds of Christians move toward a more progressive understanding of love. Because I think both Jesus and the Universalists were always right. Right in the lives that we seek to lead, lives of goodness, of beauty, of compassion, and in the communities and societies that we seek to build. Beloved communities, communities of fairness and justice, of cooperation, of diversity, of healing, communities of moral beauty. And in the end, in all of that vision and aspiration, it is indeed love that dwells in the center that we now claim should guide us in all that we do. May it ever be so. Amen.